Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So the new book, Super Bowl 50, celebrating 50 years of America's greatest game, commemorates tonight's golden anniversary of the biggest annual event in the world of sports. More than just a football game, the Super Bowl has become a cultural celebration of sports and entertainment that engages people from all walks of life. The book is filled with beautiful archival photography and original illustration, highlighting the games, the teams, scores, players, MVPs, all the big plays, halftime shows, parties with family and friends, recipes, beer, beverages, and more. And this morning, journalist, sports writer, and author Bethany Bradshaw joins us to tell us all about it. Good morning, Bethany.
Good morning, Dave. What a great day to be talking.
Happy Super Bowl Sunday to you. I think that's a greeting. We can do that, right?
I believe so. It is a national holiday. No one's going to work or school tomorrow, right?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it's funny you say that. Last year, during the Super Bowl, we had a almost like a 20-inch blizzard, so no one did go to school the next day or work. So we'll see what happens.
That's pretty good. Yes, yeah, one can hope.
That's right. Well, very, very, very cool book. I mean, it is absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, you start off, obviously, right in the beginning of the first chapter, talking about the first three Super Bowls. And in 66, a merger deal between the NFL and AFL became a reality. In 67, it was actually called the NFL-AFL World Championship, but essentially it was the very first Super Bowl.
It was, and so it kind of was grandfathered into that name a few years later. But it was just a big football game, to be sure, but it was to establish supremacy between these two leagues, and the AFL was the upstart, and NFL loyalists didn't think they could ever equal, you know, what the NFL teams had done. So it was a different motivation, different type of event, and, of course, a third of the stadium was empty there at the Los Angeles Coliseum. Because those $12 tickets were just a little too steep. So it was a really different kind of feel. And I know that the people who attended and who helped organize it saw it as big, but I don't think they understood what big was going to become.
You know, it was the Green Bay Packers. It was the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, the Packers, of course, won the first two Super Bowls. I mean, they were the ones that really kind of kicked it all off.
They did. And it's one of those things I'm sure Packers fans like to speculate about is, had the Super Bowl started 5 years earlier, how many would they have, you know, or what would their legacy be? Because they were dominant for those years prior to this game starting. But they really gave it a great kickoff because they were just an unusually dominant team at that time. So those early games weren't all that competitive. The Jets winning Super Bowl III was certainly a huge upset. Nobody expected Joe Namath and the AFL Jets to conquer the Colts. And, you know, he was one of the very first real media darlings in the game that was just flashy and obnoxious, but he backed it up with his play. You know, you in Chicago know somebody else like that about 16 years later.
Yep.
17 years later, sorry. He really typified what was going to happen as time went on with Media Day and the players, and we're seeing it now, certainly with, you know, Cam Newton and Peyton Manning and the way that these quarterbacks are at the center of the storm, so to speak. So those early years, not so much great football, you know, edge of your seat type of football, but there were some great characters and some really surprising results. And I think, you know, when the Steel Curtain Steelers of the 70s came on the scene is when the football really started to be tremendous.
Sure.
And that defensive, you know, emphasis of Bud Carson and his defenses. And so for me, it's been neat to see the way the game changed, kind of using this one game as a lens. And that was one of the big shifts. And that was the first true Super Bowl team. And I think there are a lot of Steelers fans that were forged during those years, the you know, late 70s when they won four. And then you had a big shift with Bill Walsh in the 80s to the West Coast offense and the 49ers. So it's those kinds of things that I just think make it such a fun study, not only of the football, but then of the way culturally and all the ways this game has, you know, touched the American culture. And even people who don't care about football have to pay attention now, even though that wasn't the case 50 years ago.
Right.
Because there's so much just, you know, hoopla surrounding it in every aspect of our culture.
Talk a little bit about the, you talk about this in the beginning of the book, but talk a little bit about the Super Bowl club, the folks that have never missed a Super Bowl. Like, they've missed marriages, they've missed weddings, they've missed funerals, they've missed babies being born, but there is an exclusive club that has been to every single game.
It was so much fun. I got to interview all three of those gentlemen, and there were four until just a few years ago, when one of the members of that Never Miss a Super Bowl club unfortunately passed away. But it's so interesting because they come from, one is in the Chicago area, one is in San Francisco, one's in Maine, and they met after decades of going to Super Bowls. They finally found each other, essentially because Visa did a commercial about them, some may remember, and now they have their little 15 minutes of fame every winter. And the NFL, you know, sets them a little bit, and they get together for lunch. And so it's become a thing, you know, where they're not going to miss if they can possibly get there. But there were lean years in all three of their cases. None of them were particularly wealthy who could just charter a plane to get there, but they were all committed after a little while to being there no matter what. And it was fun just to hear about their favorite moments seen live, and also how they have seen the logistical headaches increase and the media hype increase. And I would say those three didn't particularly like those changes, but they kind of liked it a little simpler in a simpler time.
But at this point, doesn't the NFL just pay for their ticket, for God's sake, at this point of the game?
Yes, finally. But they did shell out a pretty good bit to get to this point, so I'd say that's well-deserved.
Well, I was looking at, you know, some of the stats, and it's so much fun because you go game by game and you're really talking about some really unique things that you call out. You know, one of the highlights of the 70s was that Super Bowl VI was the only game that the MVP of the game was not from the winning team in all these years and 50 years. In the first decade or so of the Super Bowl, the Pittsburgh Steelers held the title four times by that point, and they still hold the title for the most wins, I think, with six to this date.
Yeah, they really do, and that's what, you know, speaks so much to the strength of that franchise in those early years. And I think a lot of great NFL teams have modeled themselves after that team. You know, certainly, like I mentioned earlier, the Bears from Super Bowl 20 with their defense, and then the Ravens in this past decade with that. Yeah, you know, just that defense can completely manage to win a Super Bowl. And now we're looking at this Super Bowl 50 tonight with the top two defenses in the league. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But it was just fun to learn about those Steelers and some of the characters on the team, and just that classic kind of smash-mouth football that really matches what the city of Pittsburgh seems to be about.
Well, I'm going to focus a little bit on the Bears and in 1986, the 85 Bears. You know, they won the Super Bowl 20. Before, and by the way, the team, I love how you noted here that, and I didn't even know this, but the Super Bowl Shuffle was nominated for a Grammy. Really?
I don't know. Maybe that says something that our musical taste has traveled a good distance. Isn't that hilarious? That's just, I guess that was just an homage to how silly it all was.
I guess so. I
have to tell you, from my perspective, I live in North Carolina, and I ghost wrote a book with a running back named Tony Collins, who was the starting running back on that Patriots team. So Tony and I are very good friends because I worked with him for a long time on that book. And when I signed the contract to do this book, I talked to him and I said, I'm going to do a Super Bowl book. And he said, great, because that was the only Super Bowl he played in.
No.
From his point of view, it
Poor
was
guy.
Just the worst day of his life. And really, the Patriots ended up mired in a drug use scandal right after the loss. So it was like, kick them when they're down. It just got worse for Tony and his teammates. But I came at it from that perspective, so it was fun to learn about the Bears and just how, again, we talk about the media. They fed into that pretty early, before that many other teams had caught on that this was a thing, and again, backed it up on the field.
Yeah, Walter and Peyton and Jim McMahon, we're going to actually have Jarrett and Brittany Peyton on with us right after this to talk about the NFL Man of the Year Award. But, you know, they were the focus of the press, all until the Bears, 46-10 trouncing of the Patriots, as you said. And I was looking at some of the points that you made here, and it's the 30th anniversary is when the assault on New England was finally over. The Bears had only allowed 7 rushing yards and 116 yards in the air, and they had permitted New England to convert only one third down on 10 attempts. They also had set a new Super Bowl record for sacks with 7, fewest rushing yards allowed, and largest margin of victory. But there was a controversy that came in the game.
Are you talking about the William Perry controversy?
Yeah.
Yes. So, well, and it was, and I know you said you're going to talk to Walter Payton's family members, that, you know, the idea that, that Walter Payton should have had a touchdown in that historic win, and that he did not, and yet William Refrigerator Perry did have the opportunity.
Right. And we all remember that.
Yeah. That seem a little bit backwards, and but, you know, certainly I know in that city, that's, and particularly with, there's a 30 for 30, I know, coming out, which I'm really looking forward to, but all the aspects of that story make it one of the more unique Super Bowls. It really stood out for me through my research. Not that it was a great game, but it had some peripheral storylines that were fantastic.
Well, when we come back, the 90s and a new century of Super Bowls with author Bethany Bratcher, next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to author Bethany Bratcher about her new book, Super Bowl 50, Celebrating 50 Years of America's Greatest Game. So before we jump into the 90s, I was looking at this, the first Gatorade shower, because you have everything in this book. That's what makes this book so much fun, was Super Bowl 21 with the New York Giants. And obviously that has become quite a tradition.
It really has. And you know, now you can place a prop bet on the color of the Gatorade.
I know. I just saw that. Do you know what the winning one is for this year? You know what the high? It's orange. They're thinking it's going to be orange.
Well, I guess that's the whole Broncos. We're going back to the orange crush.
Yeah.
Days, I guess.
So
you think Broncos, you think orange drink, and it all comes out. I mean, I mentioned, I live in North Carolina, so I'm not thinking that way, but I'm sure that's where that came from.
1988 marked the first year with a black quarterback starting the Super Bowl, Doug Williams for the Redskins. In 89, the San Francisco 49ers are the only team to win back-to-back Super Bowls under different head coaches, one under Bill Walsh and the other under George Seifert. That's pretty cool. I mean, to think about that. And why, I don't remember this. Why did Bill Walsh leave the 49ers that year after winning the Bowl?
He had a bit of a conflict with the front office, and so it was a curious thing, because he really did build that team and what was going on there. So that, you know, I think people tend to forget that he wasn't presiding over that second victory, because you just think Bill Walsh, and he's the one that built that team. So he had an interesting career trajectory for sure, but wins, he's recognized in the book as one of the top Super Bowl coaches of all time. And along with, you know, Bill Belichick, Chuck Knoll, Joe Gibbs. You know, Joe Gibbs was a great Super Bowl coach. It's just interesting when you look. He pulled out some victories with the Redskins that people didn't expect, you know, his team to be able to win. So
sure.
That was fun to look at those leaders and what they meant to their team.
91, played just weeks after the U.S. went into the Persian Gulf War. Super Bowl 25 was marked by a long patriotic halftime show, which I totally remember, with Whitney Houston singing the Star-Spangled Banger. It was also a tight game. It was Giants 20, Bills 19. And just a couple years later, Michael Jackson had the halftime show. When did the halftime shows become huge? Because they weren't like the big deal as they are now in the very beginning.
No, you just said the year. It was 93 with Michael Jackson. Now, 91 was the first time you had a pop group perform, and that was New Kids on the Block. Prior to that, they seemed to major in Up With People, regrettably, and college marching bands. It was really interesting. It was more of a college halftime feel. And so, but Michael Jackson in 93 was that iconic pop star performance that really changed the way people viewed the halftime show. And it was actually the first time that the ratings went up during halftime. So suddenly, Jim Steig, who was considered kind of the Super Bowl czar, and he worked for the NFL, and he was the one that sort of engineered this change, and he sort of realized, hey, this is something we need to capitalize on and start to make this a huge production unto itself. And boy, did they. And, you know, it's just seems to have taken on a life of its own, really.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we had the geriatric rockers phase with the Rolling Stones and Paul McCartney and The Who, and, you know, they rolled out a whole series of aging rockers for us at that period. But it's always fun. I'm not sure I'm a fan of the Coldplay choice, but, you know,
they stayed safe since the Janet Jackson thing. They've just kept it kind of cool, you know.
Yeah, Coldplay's probably not going to have a wardrobe malfunction. Now, here's Super Bowl trivia. As we talk about the game touching every aspect of the culture, did you know that the wardrobe malfunction in 2004 helped launch YouTube?
No.
So many people were looking for videos of that incident the next day and couldn't find them, that the founders of YouTube saw an opportunity and launched this, you know, ubiquitous.
That's right.
Now.
The
Super Bowl really does touch every aspect.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Then you got 94, despite losing all four, the Buffalo Bills are the only team to play in four consecutive Super Bowls and lose every one of them. Oh, my gosh, I can't even imagine.
You were just talking about 91 and wide right. And speaking of 30 for 30s, that was a heart-wrenching one with the four falls of Buffalo. But, you know, one of the parts of the book that I really enjoyed, or it was insightful for me, as I got to interview Ernie Accorsi, who was an executive at the NFL for so many years with the Colts and later with the Giants, and he kind of gave me his insight and said that losing a Super Bowl is worse than not going at all. And I've looked at Marv Levy's biography and some interviews with the early Vikings, who also lost four, although not consecutively. And, you know, not everyone agrees with him, but he said he'd rather not make it than lose. That it is the most kind of singularly painful thing in sports. And, you know, he's become a friend of mine, and it was kind of interesting to get that inside perspective.
Sure. And then you've got 2007, the Colts suffered through the longest drought between Super Bowls, 36 years. It was led by Peyton Manning. 2013, first time ever that two brothers, Jim Harbaugh, the 49ers, and John Harbaugh, the Ravens, have coached against each other in a Super Bowl. I wonder if we'll ever see that again, though. I mean, that was pretty unique, right?
It was. I can't imagine. I don't think we'll see two brothers, the ones that we're thinking of, play against each other in the Super Bowl either. But, yeah, the Harbaugh was interesting. That was also the Blackout Bowl, if you recall, in New Orleans.
Yep.
And one of my favorite stories about the NFL and how it's become this big brother, you know, kind of our culture, is that in that game, the Ravens were dominating before the blackout and after the blackout, which was like 34 minutes of nothingness. And you remember the broadcasters trying to fill that airtime? It was beautiful.
Yeah.
But after the blackout, the 49ers almost came back. I mean, they went on this incredible run and made it a game. And in the years after that, it hasn't been that many years, but in the Ravens players who said that the NFL had engineered the whole thing to create a better game.
Wow.
You know, that they really doubted the stories of the Superdome officials. And I think that's great. I love it. They spoke out and said, this can't be a coincidence. Roger Goodell is behind this whole thing.
So. Well, and then the biggest story behind this, you know, 2015, nearly 114 million people watched the game, making the fifth time in 6 years the Super Bowl set a record. And by the way, I think there's only one outside of the Super Bowl filling the top 10. I think MASH is the only final episode of a show that made the top 10 of the most watched TV of all time, and they say 2016 it might hit 115.5 million. So the rest is history.
Yeah. It just grows every year in every way. And I've had people ask me, you know, what will we see? How will it continue to kind of outgrow the bounds of what we see now? And you know, will there be a Super Bowl played overseas? And I don't know about that. I think the NFL would like to see that happen. I'm not sure if it will ever occur. But I do think social media is kind of the main platform that's going to keep expanding this game, just with all the reach and all the tweets and the advertisers that let their commercials leak via social media platforms. And so it's really made it even bigger, as if that could be possible. And now we're looking at $5 million for a 30-second spot tonight.
Pretty crazy, yeah.
I don't even understand what that means. You know, compute as real money in my world, but that's amazing.
Well, the new book, and it's a fabulous new collectible book. It's Super Bowl 50, celebrating 50 years of America's greatest gaming. Pick it up at Amazon or your local bookseller. Now, do you have a pick for tonight's game, Bethany?
Well, I've told you my loyalties. I am a North Carolinian, and I covered the Carolina Panthers for their first two seasons as a beat writer in 95 and 96. So I don't think I can separate the sentimentality of that. But given all that, I've watched them play more closely than any other team, and I do think that we're looking at the Panthers. I'm going to say by 10.
All right. Thanks, Bethany. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. WGN's Jared Payton and Brittany Payton joins me from Santa Clara, California, next on 720 WGN.